Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. I'm not going to ask Armin how he is right now because we have just 1 hour and we have a lot of stuff to cover. We're talking about recent events in Afghanistan. We have a fantastic guest here today to talk to us about it. So as many of you know, well, I think as everybody knows, like, the world has been shaken with all these horrific images of what's happening in Afghanistan, with the Afghans are trying to flee. They're holding on to airplanes. They're and falling off of them. They're trying to hide. They're doing anything to avoid the Taliban, who have taken over the country in just days. So right now, the main problem is that there are many translators and interpreters, humanitarian aid workers who worked with the U.S., who will be seen as traitors by the Taliban, and they're going to round them up, and they're going to do, you know, well, you can imagine what they're going to do to them. So particularly Afghan women and girls who have been going to school, many of them have been getting an education, and now they're going to be ripped away from the schools, and they're going to be it's going to be a pretty bleak future, including being forcibly married to Taliban soldiers. So, and all of this is just an understatement. So we have today Jason Brisebois. He is a former member of the Canadian Forces. He was with the Canadian Forces Protective Services Unit. He worked in Kabul and Kandahar, and he also helped facilitate aid shipments to charities and to girls' schools. And Jason, welcome to the show, and thank you for doing this and joining
us. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start by talking about this. I mean, you posted, you're also a photographer. So you posted a lot of pictures that you took yourself in Afghanistan when you were there. And they were, just really moving. I think you posted a whole collage of them, and especially of kids and things that you'd seen through your eyes. It seemed like that was Afghanistan through your eyes. What was it like when you were there? And can you just tell us about, just start with your impression of it?
Every Canadian soldier's first introduction to Afghanistan is Kandahar. That's where we land and where we deploy from. And Kandahar Air Base is very different than Kabul and the rest of, northern Afghanistan. It's very hot, very dry. And what strikes you the most when you land is the smell. It's generally, there's a giant, septic pond in the middle of Kandahar airfield that you never escape that smell. Once we deployed to Kabul, which is where I operated out of, I was part of the Canadian Forces Protective Services Unit. We protected the Canadian ambassador in Kabul and on his mission there. And Kabul itself is very different than Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. It's cooler, mountainous. Like I was mentioning before, you can search for and you can see all the horrors that man has done to other men there, and you can see it's in front of you. But there's also a lot of beauty, a lot of the old Afghanistan that was for 20 years trying to find a foothold again, trying to crawl out into the light. And we don't know what's going to happen to that now.
And you worked with local Afghans there.
You're working alongside. The Canadian embassy employed a lot of local Afghans in many areas. We also, because I mean, Canada sponsored so many humanitarian efforts in Afghanistan, either directly through the Canadian government or supporting other Canadian initiatives that were, you know, privately being done there. And as the Canadian ambassador, the head of mission, his responsibility was to oversee all of that. He would very often he would tour a lot of them, he would visit a lot of them, and we, as his protective services team, would be with there right there with him the entire time.
Wow. So, So I wanted to, what's happened now recently, like with the, you know, you had the withdrawal that was, I mean, negotiated by the Trump administration in May May 2021. And then this new administration, the Biden administration, actually executed it. And obviously it's getting a lot of criticism for the way that it was done. As you've been seeing the events of the last few days and weeks, what has your reaction been? I mean, you worked with some of these people, you worked with girls' schools, you worked with the women there. What have you been feeling as you've been seeing all these things?
Crushing. It's been a crushing feeling. I've been in contact with a lot of my old team and other members of the Canadian Forces who were there, friends of mine, and we all share a very similar feeling, and that's it's hollow and robbed, I think, are two great ways to describe it. We feel like everything we did there has been for nothing. We feel as though the people that we tried to help haven't even been given a chance to get off the ground, basically, quite literally haven't been able to get a chance, you know, given a chance to get off the ground. It's a horrible feeling. It's a horrible sinking feeling.
Yeah. Armin?
There are some people from Afghanistan telling us that we're looking at everything through our own secular, Western, democratic, feminist perspectives. And most of the people who are judging what's happening based on a very narrow-minded view of their understanding of what people want, not in Afghanistan, but maybe in the liberal part of Kabul, or some of the more educated Afghan people who are more on the media, who we have more in touch with, who we hear more from. But they, again, I'm not saying this is true or not. I'm just saying that this is, they're saying like, and the Afghan woman that we seem to be worried about seem to be only the Afghan woman in these societies, maybe in main cities, and also in the better part of the cities. But overall, things might actually even become better for Afghan women as a whole. Yes, they will lose some freedom. Yes, maybe they have to cover up. Yes, maybe they would have some, a few of them that have access now to education will not have access to education, but there will not be war, right? Like, we keep talking to the people, for example, because of the US occupation, now they have access to education that didn't, they had access to politics that they didn't, they were even on the parliament and everything that was impossible before. But we don't talk to all the women's in the other areas, which were like, you know, they had bombs falling on them, had shootings with the Taliban's, keep losing their children and their husband, didn't know if they're like, when they're doing their work, going between different villages, they didn't know if they're going to come back. That's going to stop now. And maybe those Afghan women maybe they prefer the fact that the current situation over what was before. So what do you think?
I think there's that warrants a second look, definitely. I mean, let's ask the people of Iraq, you know, what was life like before and after Saddam Hussein? You know, Saddam Hussein may have been a despot, he may have been a horrible human being, but all things considered, compared to life after Saddam Hussein, there was relative peace in Iraq before the U.S. involvement, before Saddam was ousted. So, yeah, I mean, there's always an argument to be said for, you know, better a devil you know that you can control and is peaceful than one that is unleashed and you know, causing havoc in your country. So, I'd say there's merit to that. At the same time, what happened in Afghanistan was definitely not a perfect solution. I don't think there's too many examples in history of real change being effected at the point of a gun and lasting. I think that real change has to come from a change of ideas, a change of beliefs. And, the American involvement was probably doomed from a very, very early point. But I think there's something to be said for giving freedom a chance and giving people who want a better life a chance, rather than limiting, rather than quashing their hopes and dreams, which is what's going to happen now, which has always happened under the Taliban.
Right. And what's your take on, well, I mean, you know, currently the actual execution of it. So, you know, we had, or the withdrawal of the troops. I mean, do you think that it was done? And because, you know, what they're saying is they took four U.S. presidents, $2 trillion, and, you know, many deaths, soldier deaths, civilian deaths, all of that, to replace, and 20 years to replace the Taliban with the Taliban.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So there's, and I, you know, you said that it feels like everything you did there is for naught, that it was, you know, there was no point to it. How do you think this could have been done differently? I mean, was this doomed years ago and should have stopped years ago? The result.
Well, like I said, if there's one thing I said before, if there's one thing we've learned from history, is that we don't learn from history. Right. This, you know, the examples of occupying countries and trying to change regimes and trying to affect change, like I said, through the point of a gun. Show me an example in history where that has had a lasting and positive impact. You know, I'm not an expert in history.
World War II?
That's an example of change that was achieved at the point of a gun. But we're talking about a belief system here. Talking about changing people's belief system. You know, the Nazi party wasn't a global belief system.
Okay. Oh, by the way, it's Jason. We don't. Yeah. YouTube doesn't like it when we use the N-word.
That's okay.
I do it all the time too.
The fascists out there. I'd say World War II is there's also an example. I've always been, you know, as a security expert, there's a big difference between the use of violence and the use of force. And, you know, people say, you know, I don't want to get involved. I don't like violence. Well, getting involved doesn't mean you have to be violent. Getting involved sometimes just means the correct use of force. I think I'm probably getting a little off topic here.
This is very interesting that you're highlighting this, because one thing that we wonder is that the successes in the recent history of the United States has been in World War II and also the Cold War. But ever since, it's been like defeat after defeat.
I wouldn't necessarily classify the Cold War as a success by any side. But I see your point.
Well, ideologically, like, we could say that relatively to the other side, the Western allies came on top relatively to the other side. But both of these wars were both kind of a mix of military competition, but also ideological competition.
Yes.
And I feel like Western European and North American countries didn't just win because of their better military, but also because ideologically they managed to win that, right? Like, capitalism won the hearts and minds of people over communism, and also the Germans' ideology was so so abhorrent that defeating that one wasn't that very difficult. But these new wars that United States and other Western countries are involved in, the ideologies that they're facing with are much more deep rooted and more ancient and harder to compete with, that just like those battles that they won was both military and ideological. This one, they're just only hoping to win with military, and you can't do that because they're not winning the ideological fight. And exactly. This is a mix of religions and also ethno-nationalistic, tribal nationalistic allegiances that is just, you can't compete with that. There's no, unless you come up with a much bigger plan on changing people's hearts and minds, which governments can't even do when it comes to religion. This is supposed to be, I think, a bottom-up approach rather than a top-down approach. What do you think?
Well, offering, I mean, people, you have to offer people a better deal at the end of the day. It doesn't matter what you're trying to get them to do or what, how you're trying to change their minds. You have to offer them a reason to want to change. And if you don't understand certain, you know, factors in Afghanistan, like, you know, Afghanis are tribal first and Afghan second, you know, and if you don't understand how tribalism impacts the decision making and the allegiances of the Afghans, you're already way behind, you know, way behind in your effort.
Do you think the U.S. administrations that have been there have understood this? Like that?
Again, I'm you're asking me to you know, I couldn't possibly begin to understand or know what previous administrations understood or knew about Afghanistan, but it seemed like in a lot of cases there's a very myopic approach to winning over the hearts and minds of an ancient culture and you know a religious fundamentalism. People will, religion is something people will like you said, like Armin said, it's at the core of their being, and they're not going to change their religious beliefs or alter their religious beliefs, for much. And definitely not at the point of a gun. It's not like we were asking the Afghan people to change their religious beliefs. That wasn't, to my knowledge, that was never on the table and should never be on the table. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're asking for is... Yeah, that's fair enough.
That's what we do.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, good. Finish what you were saying. Well,
You should never ask people to change their religious beliefs. Asking them to accept, you know, more liberal approaches to those beliefs, maybe, but you have to give them a good reason to do it. And you know, what was in it for the Afghan people to want to change? You know, as we were referring to before, change was only going to mean more war.
Right. So what's really interesting about this to me is, you know, a lot of people are now saying, you know, people are upset with the images and everything that's coming out of Afghanistan. They're saying, some of them are saying that they shouldn't have withdrawn, you know, their presence should have stayed. But more people think that they should have withdrawn. That's why the withdrawal happened. I mean, the majority of Americans, at least, you know, they wanted the withdrawal of U.S. troops. So Joe Biden, when he was vice president under Obama, he repeatedly had the position that they should end the Afghanistan war. He was against the surge. Yeah. He was even against the bin Laden, you know, operation. So he was like the sort of the one voice who would always push against these things. He wasn't interested in this kind of intervention going there. So what happened now is that with the withdrawal, strangely, he's been proven right, in the sense that it basically fell within days to the Taliban. That was his claim for years. But at the same time, the execution of it has just been so bad.
Right, it's been a debacle.
Lots of people are at risk. You know, what's going to happen to the women would have happened, I guess, anyway. Yeah. Like there was, I think, he very famously said, "I don't want to send my son out there for fight on to die on behalf of women's rights in Afghanistan." He didn't want that kind of intervention. But when people say that the change has to come from within Afghanistan, how does that happen? So living there and seeing, you know, the tribal stuff, the Taliban, and all of these things, the dynamics there, how do you see them actually bringing about this change from within?
My personal belief has been for a long time that the only way to affect real change in any environment like this is through education, educate, and that's obviously easier said than done, especially in a regime that does not allow the education of women or education in general. I mean, you know, you can learn one book and one book only. That's difficult. But the good news is that we live in an age now where access to information is so easy and so readily available. You need this in your hand. That's it. This gives you a window to the rest of the world. I mean, if you want to affect change in Afghanistan, you know, let's airdrop millions of these things, you know, into the country, and give the people there, give the children there, give anyone who wants it a window to the outside world. Change yeah. isn't going to happen easy. This isn't going to happen overnight or in 1, 2, or 10 or 20 years. But you want to jumpstart that change? It takes two generations. This is the way to do it, you know, yeah, or other means like that.
Starlink. We need Starlink to become cheaper for everybody.
Yeah. There you go.
And yeah. So, I mean, so for people who are listening to this on audio and they're not, Jason was holding up his yeah. smartphone. That's cool. So, and I was just having this conversation the other day. I think it was Steve Jobs had said something about how, you know, smartphones are the best form of charity rather than usually what people give. People are struggling, but it's true. What you have in your hand there is a recording studio. It's a movie studio. It's a publishing company, international distribution company. It is a university where you can get lectures. It's a, you know, self-education tool. It's just the opportunities.
To a kid in Afghanistan, that is potentially an ear to the world and a voice to the world.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, and that should not be, you know, we should not dismiss the power of that. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make one comment, Armin, before your question. And that's, you know, when you're talking about educating, and especially educating women, if you educate men, a lot of these men who are educated, they're not going to necessarily educate their daughters. But if you educate women, they will educate their daughters, and because they know they know the advantage. So that is that's actually a really key component, that educating women is actually probably
it is at the core. It is, in my opinion, educating the women is the core to affecting change anywhere.
Right. Armin.
I do want to make sure that we separate the discussion on how this was done and from whether it should have been done, because the exit from Afghanistan should have been done, right? Like a long time ago.
I 100% agree with that. Yes.
Right. And the responsibility of how bad this was done, there's a lot of blame to go around. And I understand that there are many things that Biden could have done better. For example, coming up with a faster process for the activists and the people who helped the U.S. government to get out faster would have been amazing. But there are many, like, I just want people to understand that there are other actors here that are very responsible as well. Like the Trump administration was responsible for doing the withdrawal deal with the Taliban, and the conditions for, like, it was so fast, it was so without much expert analysis, and it was so unconditional. The only condition that was major in that agreement with Taliban was just this promise by the Taliban that they wouldn't let like radical groups to grow, the anti-American radical groups to grow in Afghanistan. Nothing about the method of the withdrawal, nothing about power sharing, any agreement with power sharing with other elements. There was nothing there. And it was so fast that even Biden, who was so eager to get out of Afghanistan, was like, this is too fast. May is too fast. We need to come out at September. Like, Biden was very eager to get Afghanistan, but even what Trump signed with Taliban was even too fast for Biden. Like, they had, like, they needed a few other months. Like, one thing you could have put in the agreement, for example, was like making sure in the agreement was a process for people, for American allies to get out, making it a two-tier withdrawal. First, U.S. Army will get out of everywhere except of Kabul. Stay a few more months in Kabul for processing of the people who need to get out and for securing a peaceful transfer of power and everything. Like, there's so many things that could have been done better. And Biden inherited all of that. And Biden could not have undid that agreement that Trump did, because that would have made Taliban not come and do any other agreement, because the agreement that was already signed was thrown out of the door.
Right.
So and also there's a lot of blame to go around for Afghan's government. Like, please, like, people need to understand, like, You gave them 20 years of training and investment and equipment, and then as soon as you leave, there's absolutely zero resistance. Like, I mean, if the Afghan army is not going to fight for Afghanistan, like, what's the expectations for other, like, American army to fight for Afghanistan? But what do you think?
I think you got some very good points there. I mean, there's four different administrations that this war has covered, and I think right. Each one of those administrations shares equal blame in this debacle.
Well, not equal. Bush gets the most.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Bush started us down this road. But you're right. Biden inherited this. A lot of this has to do with the Trump administration and their mismanagement of it. At the same time, this happened under Biden's watch. And sure, Biden may not have been, or Biden may have been in a tough spot to, if he'd pushed it further down the line, he would have upset the Taliban and everything like that. Well, first of all, I mean, since when are we upset about, since when are we worried about upsetting the Taliban? Secondly, there was a lot he could have done between his, his coming into power and now that could have eased this along. I mean, you only have to spend 5 minutes with the Afghan National Army to understand that, once the NATO forces and once the U.S. pulled out, it was going to take a total of 3 seconds before Afghanistan fell. People ask me, like, when I came back from Afghanistan, so what do you think is going to happen when everyone pulls out? And I said, I give it 3 weeks. I kid you not. That was what I said. I give it 3 weeks. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
You knew it. Our biggest threat as a close protection team with the Canadian ambassador wasn't so much the Taliban. It was the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. I mean, whenever right. we'd be out in public with them, whenever we'd be at meeting with various governors or whatever, and we're surrounded by the ANP and the ANA, our eyes were on the barrels of their guns more than we were worried about the Taliban, which one of their barrels was going to come up, and who amongst them got a better deal the night before from the Taliban to try and take out one of their allies, that kind of thing. And so wow. We were constantly on the look for that. Like I said, you only had to spend 5 minutes with them to understand that country was going to fall in a heartbeat.
Did you? So when Joe Biden made his speech the other day, and mm-hmm. he actually, he was criticized for putting the blame on the Afghans, right? He said mm-hmm. that, but didn't he have a point? I mean, when he said
he did,
like the fact that
he, yeah, 100% had a point. If you are, if the Afghan army isn't willing to fight for their country, why are we?
Yeah.
Right. It's and there was a lot of criticism for it, and some of the criticism was right. I mean, it's a whole lot easier to fight for what you believe in when you've got your big brother behind you, backing you up. But if that guy isn't there, it's a pretty bleak outcome. One of the things that I used to say when I my impressions of the Afghan people when I was there was, for the most part, was that at the end of the day, most of them really did not care about politics or extremist religion. They just wanted to put food on their table and feed their kids and have a better life and do whatever it took to achieve a better life. So to ask them to suddenly get, this may not be the best term, but to suddenly develop a spine and to suddenly get all hot and bothered about defending their country, that kind of thing, when all they want to do is feed their kids and have a good life. That is maybe expecting a lot from people,
That's actually very interesting, because that seems to be, I'm not sure, but that seems to be the disconnect that we're like, we as like secular activists or like pro freedom, we having like, and with the contact that we have with the Afghans that want the same thing, we seem to like to, a lot of people can't, are completely disconnected from many other Afghans that are like, we just want to be able to go to work and just whoever is going to stop the war, whatever, at whatever means, that our security but a lot of people who remember the Taliban will say that actually, yes, we had less freedom during the Taliban. Again, I'm not saying this is, I'm not like, please don't come tell me that but Afghans say a lot of Afghans say, well, we had more security and we had less corruption. I mean, the previous government of Afghanistan was extremely corrupt. And the money was, and all the trillions, like all the money that the United States was spending on the army, like a lot of it was disappearing. A lot of it was going to ghost soldiers. A lot of it was these generals of Afghan's army that were like, funneling it into their own personal, you know, accounts
true,
and everything.
True, but at the same time, under the Taliban regime, you know, before the U.S. involvement, corruption may not have been a big factor, because what money was there to be corrupt about? I mean, there was no money trickling down to, you know, the infrastructure of the country. It was, right. You know, it was all being put towards, military, religious, you know, religious extremism, that kind of thing. So right. There's an argument to be said that, the lack of corruption may have just been a complete lack of money.
Right. Well, they think there was more security. There was less war. There was less more security.
Right. I mean,
and people are saying and even people who are saying that it will be sad that we will lose some of our freedoms, some of them are saying
it's
yes, that's exactly what they're saying. Like, you know, it might
be. You can't fault them for that. I mean, if I was in their position, and I had a family, and you know, what would I want? I'm given a choice. My daughter's not going to get educated, or my house isn't going to get blown up.
Right.
You know. So that's a tough call.
Yeah.
But
another
go on. Can't we maybe just crazy idea, have both? You know. Educate my daughter and not have my house blow up.
I think that might be like a longer term. I think that's something that you can't just force upon people, right? I mean, other people who have tried to force that kind of a attitude on people with like from a top down approach have been Ataturk, Reza Shah. I forgot the guy in Egypt who tried this as well. But then as soon as they left, that didn't last, you know. Mm-hmm. Ataturk actually had more success. Well, now we're saying Turkey is becoming more Islamized and stuff like that, but at least it had the more lasting effect. But I'm just saying, like, what we want, instead of this top-down approach of, like, here's secularism, here's woman education, what we want is a repeat of what happened maybe in Western Europe, like during the Age of Enlightenment, right? Because that was more of a changing the mindset of the people from the bottom up. And that's what we want to repeat. And that's something that governments, I don't think, can do. That's something that activists and educators, like what you say, you have people need more education. That's something that
dropping cell phones.
Just more education, more access to us, and for them to be able to talk to us and we talk to them. These are, I think, this is a more longer term investment approach that will get us the results that we want. You can't just like gift it to people with a military, I think, right?
Yeah. That's true. I think, I think what you're trying to say, or what you are saying there, is that it does have to come from within. It has to come from the change has to come from the people who are being affected by it, not from an outside source, and definitely not at the point of a gun.
I mean, we have stats, and this is something that people, the patrons are asking as well. Ali, I don't know if you want to ask it right now, because we have stats about people's attitudes in Afghanistan, and Ali, maybe you want to bring that up right now.
So on Patreon. So we got this question from Stephanie Seidel. She's saying there these days there's a poll that's getting cited from, I think it's from Pew, that says that 99% of Afghans agree with Sharia and they want Sharia rule. So when you were there, just based on your impression being there, did you think that was true? And if that is true, then why are so many people trying to flee? Why are they trying to leave? Is it that, or is it just the way they interpret it?
Well, I think there's two factors involved here. First of all, I was in Kabul, and Kabul was kind of like, I guess, the metropolitan, cosmopolitan. If there is a cosmopolitan center of Afghanistan, it was in Kabul. And so I think in every, you know, major metropolis and every major cosmopolitan center, you're going to get more liberal thinkers. You're going to get people you're going to get the people who are trying to get out of Afghanistan right now, who have the most to lose under the Taliban. So I think there was just a higher concentration of that in Kabul. Because I saw a lot of a lot of young women not wearing burqas, where the older, I mean, again, I had no idea what was under the burqa, but I could just only assume that an older belief system of the women wearing burqas, suddenly, you know, now we have younger women going out without burqas. Headscarves, sure, you know, and scarves around their heads, certainly, but no burqas. My friend Paula Danilevich, she's going to kill me for butchering her name. she was one of the key people that I worked with to provide aid to a girls' orphanage in Afghanistan. And this place was so secretive, even though we were the ones providing the aid, because we were men, we were not allowed to know its location. And we completely respected that. So we handed off the aid to, you know, to a go-between, you know, a female go-between. And we got pictures back of these girls who, you know, all young girls, anywhere from, you know, like toddlers all the way up to women in the early 20s, being given a chance, being given a life, being given an opportunity to learn and to be better than just a war bride under the Taliban, that kind of thing. And these were the women in Kabul who had a chance. And, you know, we saw so much of that in Kabul. Now you go down to Kandahar, that's a different story altogether. You know, the southern Afghanistan is, you know, Kandahar is the headquarters, or was once the headquarters for the Taliban. And so the belief system there is very, very different. You did not see any of that in Kandahar at all.
Interesting. And there are some people are pointing to the polls that shows like there's 99% support for Sharia, and actually like there's 79% for support, for example, for executing ex-Muslims, people who left Islam. There's 79% support for that in Afghanistan, right? Yeah. But then there are people like, well, that can't be true, because we have contradicting poll that shows in the recent years support for Taliban had gone down. But I don't think these are contradictory, because the support for Taliban going down might have been because of all the war that was happening and people were tired mm-hmm. of the war. And maybe for the same reason why they were against the reason the popularity went down, because they're tired of the war. I'm speculating right now. Maybe a lot of them will now welcome Taliban taking over, because, you know, they didn't like Taliban because of all the war. And now mm-hmm. they might be like, well, we don't like them, but we want them to take over so that the war ends, or something like that. And another thing that people point out, Jason, I don't know if you were exposed to any of this or not. People right now keep talking about like Taliban having, I don't know, sex slaves or, but a lot of people say that the warlords that United States was working with, they had sex slaves, you know, children as sex slaves. And these are people that a lot of US Army staff were trying to bring attention to, and they were yeah. commanded from the higher ups not to. This will hurt our relationship with them. That yeah. let it just yeah. happen. So oh, like yeah.
there's a very know. Famous case of some U.S. Special Forces soldiers who were court-martialed for intervening in a case where a young boy was being sexually abused by an Afghan National Army higher up in the Afghan National Army. And
so let's just be clear: they were being court-martialed for trying to stop the child abuse. Yes.
And I'm not recalling the names or the dates or anything like that, but yes, we saw evidence of that in Afghanistan. I mean, I never saw any direct abuse, because I probably would have been right next to them in the court martial as well if I had. But it was a known fact that there were. I mean, It's so funny, because homosexuality is illegal under Sharia law, is punishable by death under Sharia law. But having sex with a 12-year-old boy, totally fine.
Yeah, it's called bachabazi. That's what it's called.
Right? We saw signs of that. We saw evidence of that while we were there, and it was horrible to know about it.
Yeah.
A lot of them do have this assumption that if you're a top, that's not homosexuality. That's some of them feel like that as well. So there's
exactly. I'm not even going to get into the psychology behind that, but that was the case.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to like just make a comment about these polls. A lot of times I feel like they're somewhat one dimensional, because you remember in the US you had these polls, you ask everybody, are you for socialism, and everyone's like, no, we don't like socialism. Then you ask them the individual things, well, do you want universal healthcare, single payer, do you support, and then it turns out they support a lot of these measures that say Bernie Sanders is promoting, but they don't like Bernie Sanders. You know, so that kind of thing happens when people, individual Sharia components, you know, they'll be for it or against it. But when you ask them if they want Sharia law, it's I've heard people, they're sort of very the reform crowd, right? A lot of the reform Muslims and the progressive Muslims, they say Sharia law is not that much different from the U.S. Constitution. They actually say it. They say it's about freedom of speech, right, and women's rights, but it's a lot of times.
Ali, that's why, that's why I cite the other parts of this poll as well. That when so people say, well, what do they mean by Sharia law? So maybe 99% they think believe in Sharia law, but they think Sharia law includes freedom of speech, which is ridiculous. But that's why the other parts of the poll, which shows that 79% favor like death penalty for leaving Islam, you know, so, and also women, 30% believe men and women. Only 30% believe men and women should have equal inheritance rights, for example.
Yeah, right? This is, but even that, and that, you're right. I agree that that's a lot more concrete, but even that is, sometimes it's loaded, because you'll see this in my own extended family. Like, I'll find people, you talk to them, you're like, is it okay? Like what the Prophet did and married a 9-year-old, is that okay? And they'll say, yeah, that's fine. There's nothing wrong. I'm like, would you let anybody marry your 9-year-old daughter? And they're like, no. Yes. No. So they'll know me as an ex-Muslim and as an atheist, and they'll be like, oh, you're a really nice guy, but I think that generally people should be killed. There's like, that's human true. Beings that's are, yeah, they're very...
However,
it's not just Islam. Every Abrahamic religion has that. Every Abrahamic
religion has these. Well, not to this extent. Not to this extent, but yes, they have problems. Not
to that extent, but they have problems. I mean, there's so many examples in, you know, the Christian Bible of horrors being enacted under the, you know, under the name of God, and it being perfectly fine. And you ask Christians now, were they okay with it? Yeah, totally, totally okay with it. Would you do it now? Oh no. Like, you know, so yeah, I mean, it's very, very strange.
That's the thing with the religious mindset, is it is a conglomeration of contradictions. Like, there's a cognitive dissonance is an inherent part of it. But anyway,
I do want to challenge what Ali was saying just a little bit, because yes, it's true that if like 99%, for example, of the people of country want Sharia law, not all of that means the same thing, or even, but it is a big number, right?
Yeah.
And it's all, and when, let's say, when, okay, yeah, 79% of people of Afghanistan, if they think that you should be executed for leaving Islam, maybe not all of that 79% would actually want to carry that themselves, but 79% is bigger, it's too big of a number. It's a very bad number. And also, A big percentage of them will be like, okay, sure, I'll do it myself as well. And also, the problem is that we have to look at these numbers relative to other countries. Like, if you look at Afghanistan numbers relative to other Islamic countries, Afghanistan is worse than Iraq, worse than Pakistan, for crying out loud, worse than Bangladesh, worse than Palestine. Like, it has some of the worst numbers, even not relative to all the countries, relative to even the worst of Islamic countries, yes. Right? So this, that's why this is like...
We don't disagree. We don't completely disagree. And I'll just make this really quick. Yeah, like, in the sense that I agree, like the same people who may say that, okay, no, Ali, we know you. We don't think you should be executed. You're a nice guy. But if there's some sort of stranger out there, then they would support like mob rule and blasphemy stuff for other people. So you're right. I mean, it's not a good thing. I'm just saying that, you know, it is more complex than people read it to be.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah.
Should we get to some questions? We have 20 minutes. We have a lot of patron questions, so let's get to that.
Before we do go to patron question, Jason, is there anything you wanted to add before we start asking some of the questions?
No. I will let you guys take the lead.
Ask the questions. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Ali, cool.
All right. So
sometimes we talk too much, and we might not let you to speak. That's why I always want to.
That's okay.
Yeah. That's how it happens here. Okay. So let's go. What are you going to highlight?
Oh, I just before I highlight anything, I want to highlight something that Jason sent us, which is interesting. So maybe we should highlight this.
Yes.
Jason, do you want to tell us what this is?
Oh, yes. This a friend of mine sent me a link to this. This is a GoFundMe effort that is being sponsored by Marcus. Tommy Marcus, which to my understanding, he is the name behind the Quentin Quarantino character from memes and the internet right now. And what they're doing here is they're raising money to allow more flights to go back to Kabul to take out people who need and want to leave. The original aim was for one flight at $225,000 or $250,000, and they're at almost $5.5 million now. So
$5.5 million they raised. Yeah. I think it looks like it's finished.
They keep upping the goal because they keep blowing through the goal.
Finished. You can donate.
Yeah, they keep blowing through the goal as soon as they set a new one. It's an incredible effort, and I really hope that this gets the flights and the planes and everyone to where they need to be.
Yeah. So again, that's a GoFundMe, a flyaway emergency Afghan rescue mission. So just look that up, and if you'd like to donate, it would be great if you could donate. And I think we're all going to do it.
They were trying to raise $200,000. So far, they raised $5.5 million. I really hope this goes to good use. So
I agree. Question.
You ask them. I'm not going to be able to find them. Hire them. Ask them.
So this one's like from 11:25 p.m. It's by Nusantara Rising, and this kind of goes to what you were saying about the tribal sort of dynamic there. Mm-hmm. So. They're saying the Taliban are an Islamist movement, but they also based themselves in Pashtun identitarianism. For this reason, should the state have been dissolved into nation states before the U.S. left, as in split up?
Oh, like as in like give each province in Afghanistan its kind of own autonomy, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Oh, I really that's an interesting question. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on these subjects, but there's enough reason for the various tribes and the various regions to want to distrust and to dislike each other. I don't think creating actual formal political boundaries between them and giving each state its own autonomy or nation power would be the answer. No, I think that would just create a lot more strife within the country. For what it's worth, at least all the individual warlords and different tribes in Afghanistan can at least pretend they're all under one flag. If you give them each their own flag, that's going to make the situation worse.
Yeah,
I must very much agree with Jason here. Like,
I do too.
Changing borders on average seems to just cause so much chaos so much disaster. Yeah. I mean,
we want to bring people together here, not divide them even further.
Yeah, especially when it comes to outside.
Just don't touch borders. just don't mess with borders. Like, it's not the cost outweighs the benefit. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if you're like a foreign, you're foreign.
Exactly. I mean, it's an interesting question and one I never even thought of before, but I definitely do not think that would be the answer.
Yeah, I agree with you.
We got a super chat. We need to answer a super chat. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you, Susanna. This is actually related to the next question I was asking, so we could probably do that, bring that in. What do you think of calls to sanction Pakistan? So, you know, this is one thing I wanted to ask you about. Dolly Lasser Cosmo is also saying that Pakistan created and supported the Taliban. They cooperated with these terrorists since the U.S. embassy attack in Pakistan. Even Imran Khan, like the current prime minister, has always been known for, they've been calling him Taliban Khan, right? That was his nickname. So what do you think about that? You know, Pakistan right now is also, it has a strategic benefit in allying itself with the Taliban as a sort of a buffer against India, or so they think. I mean, that's their perception of things. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of any of that, or is that something that you saw play out while you were there?
It's not something I saw play out while I was there, but I was very much aware of the Pakistan influence. And I mean, if you're going to attack the Taliban without attacking the Taliban in Pakistan, then you're not attacking the Taliban. You have to address the source of the problem. I mean, you know, all the training camps and the recruitment centers in Pakistan are what supplied the Taliban to Afghanistan, you know? Yeah. So it's always been in Pakistan's best interest to be allies with the Taliban. And until they're given a really good reason to not be, they are going to continue to be.
So do you think they should be sanctioned? Like, just Susanna's question. Do you think they should be sanctioned?
I don't think sanctions are going to change anything. You're dealing with a nuclear state here. You know, they like it or not, they have a big gun, and you know, they have a seat at the big table, and I don't think sanctions are going to change anything.
Well, I mean,
it may bring more awareness to the problem. I think doing that might bring some more global awareness to the issue. But is it going to stop the Taliban from pouring over the border? No.
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Okay, so I want to add some few things. First of all, United States right now is in so much desperate need for Pakistan's any leverage that United States has over Pakistan. It needs to be used so much for strategical reasons that they're probably United States sends aid to Pakistan, like military aid to Pakistan. So it would be weird, like, oh, let's sanction you from one hand and also send you military aid from the other hand.
And also
Pakistan has so much leverage right now, first of all, because of how close they are to China, how much right now any influence that United States could have on Taliban would be through Pakistan. So making Pakistan angry right now might not, like, maybe be justified, but it's not in the strategic best interest of United States. But also, a lot of people don't understand that. I don't know. A lot of people maybe don't know or remember that the reason why, like, the people who, Pakistan was the country that funded Taliban at the request of the United States. Let's sanction Pakistan for supporting Taliban when we ask them. That's what happened.
You can jump back in history and see connections to what we're dealing with now has connections and so many. I guess the shockwaves of what happened so far back in the past is affecting what we're dealing with now. I mean, there's been a war in Afghanistan since quite literally Christ was a carpenter. So, that's what we're dealing with right now is just an extension of all that's come before it.
Yeah. It's kind of you were talking about the complexities of it. I'm thinking of, the good old days when they were talking about the good Taliban and the bad Taliban, and there's like the Pashtun Taliban, the other, like,
it's, well, the good old days when the US and Russia each had proxies fighting for them, They didn't have to get their hands dirty.
Yeah. So there's a question from Gossam. It's 11:39 PM, Armin, if you want to, it's okay. You don't have to highlight it. So Afghanistan, he's saying, Afghanistan was showing good moves, but now people and government are mostly hardliner Muslims. These two resonance each other. I guess they support each other, is what he's saying.
Yeah.
How will its outcomes affect the region? Do you anticipate, I'll translate what he's saying, do you anticipate more sort of terrorism or more the kind of thing, or facilitation of, I mean, they promised the U.S., like, one thing that they promised the Trump administration is they're not going to let any anti-American forces, a promise from the Taliban. What does that mean?
I mean, it's anyone's guess as to whether they'll honor that. But even if they do honor that, I think what's happened here is going to be a catalyst for more extremism in the region. It's going to embolden the various factions out there that make the US their enemy, or make the Western world their enemy, and they're going to see this as a victory, and they're going to think they are stronger because of it. I think that is one of the long-term problems and one of the long-term effects of what's happening right now that we are going to be dealing with for decades.
Hope seems to be, again, I'm not saying this will happen, okay, the hope seems to be that the Taliban doesn't want to give any excuse for any other invasion in the future. So for their own survival, they're going to be very motivated to completely, fight, these radical groups. And they're saying that these radical groups that are like maybe be motivated to do attacks on Western countries, some people say, well, Taliban might even be more effective at crushing them and keeping them out of Afghanistan than the previous Afghanistan army. Like, some people are, again, I'm not saying any of this, that's what I'm hearing people say, because they're,
could the Taliban actually end up being a stabilizing force in Afghanistan or in the region and become the police of the region? I highly doubt that.
Yeah, yeah, well,
the people are saying that if they are failed to do so, it's not going to be for the lack of trying. Like, they are motivated to do that very much so, right? They have like trillions of dollars worth of mineral wealth under them that they would want to be able to maintain. They want to be able to have trade agreements with China. China is going to be very sensitive about Taliban being able to stabilize, for example, Afghanistan. So if they fail, the understanding is because they know how to do war. They don't know how to govern, right? It's not going to be because they didn't have the motivation. It's just because they're not good governors.
Well, regardless of why they fail, I don't give them a whole lot of hope at succeeding. Especially for a regime that does not welcome. I mean, if you know, one of the, you know, the great things about leadership is if you're not good at something, find someone who is and make them your right-hand man. You know, the Taliban isn't known for bringing aboard advisors, outside advisors, and people who actually know what they're talking about to get
things done. Well, actually, it seems like they're doing that right now. Actually, they're saying they're telling Karzai, for example, like, we need you to stay with us and give us advice. And they're saying that the previous
government. In the past, known for that. And you know what? They're going to have to make some serious changes, some serious steps towards changing that before I'm going to believe it as even a remote possibility.
Yeah, I agree. I think what happens.
They're saying they're asking Karzai to come in as an advisor.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is going to stay, but right now that's what they did. They're saying again. Wow. I'm not believing them, right. But these are like weird things. So here's one reason why a lot of people are skeptical is because this kind of language was also the same kind of language that the Islamic Republic of Iran was having at the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. They were like, we're going to be very inclusive. We're going to let the communists. We're going to have women's rights. We're going to let the communists in the government. And then things change, right? But I'm not saying it's going to be exactly the same. I just said we don't know, right? It might. Yeah, so.
Right. I mean, I didn't think 2021 could get any weirder, but apparently
Me tell you another thing that happened let me tell you something else that happened that was very weird. I saw a video of, again, we have videos right now of Taliban doing some horrible things. Like, I saw them, like, shooting at the protesters. So we have examples of things going the wrong direction. But one video that they released was they showed up at the Shia Ashura gathering, right? Mm-hmm. And they were like, you guys are Shia, right? Like, are we like stopping your ceremony? And people are like, no, like, yes, we're not. We're letting you do your Shia thing, aren't we? Like, because they used to mass execute Shias, right? And then like, Shias were like, we are. Like, And then they say, like, yes, this is Afghanistan for everyone. But the Taliban respects the Shia. The Taliban is going to be a Taliban where Shias can be safe. And
that's great. That's great. But let's see what happens when the camera.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see.
Cameras have to go off. I mean, this is you're right. I think what you said there, Armin, this is exactly what happened in the beginning of the 1979, the revolution, when it was supposed to be inclusive and there were many different groups. This is kind of what they do. I have a question from there's a question from Joshua Hayes Johnson, and this is about the SIV program. So I think we have a little bit of time left. So let's see. I think after this, we may be able to do one more. But he's saying, Jason, given the huge backlog of almost 30,000 plus pending SIV applications for Afghans after Trump slashed down eligibility for the program and the deal he made with the Taliban, what could Biden have done to ensure a chaos-free withdrawal, as it seemed handicapped since before he took office? And then go
ahead.
No, he's also saying, mind you, Biden signed an executive order to expedite the SIV program, but it did little to fix the program when Trump hamstrung it.
Mm-hmm. So. I think what happened with the C-17, that famous picture that's been circulating, the 600 and something people in the back of the C-17 that took off from Kabul.
Right.
I think that should be the example. The pilot, the captain of that plane said, you know what, screw it. Let's get them off the ground and sort it out later.
Yeah.
What could Biden have done? We could have put a lot more effort into getting the people who need to get off the ground off the ground and sorting it out later. You know, again, this is all much easier said than done. There's a lot of logistics and planning that goes into that. But, you know, there are vast swaths Dubai and Qatar that could have been turned into camps for processing camps for this. You know, if they can build processing camps for migrant children in Mexico, at the drop of a hat, guess what? You can build processing camps for Afghans trying to flee for their lives in a neighboring country.
Well, Biden's administration claim, again, I'm not saying this is true, is that the Afghan government was getting in their way and not letting them do that. So that's their claim. I don't know how true that is.
You know what? At the end of the day, like I said, you get the people on the plane, you get them off the ground, you sort it out later. And you know, I've always been more of a forgiveness versus permission guy. So I'll do what needs to be done and deal with the consequences after.
Yeah, I agree with you. We're going to do one more question from Blonde Infidel, and then after that, you know, we'll just so. Blonde Infidel is asking, what can the international community do to help, and suggestions also for how secular activists can help bring about substantial change? And I think one of the things is that GoFundMe thing, right?
GoFundMe, putting pressure on your local government to put pressure, international pressure on the Taliban now, and to for however long, get them to keep their word as long as we can, as much as we can, if we can, to get those people out of there, let those people out of there. What can the secular activists do? Exactly what you guys are doing. What secular activists can do is it's talk to the person next to you. It's make friends with someone who you think might be having questions or might be wondering what to do, or it doesn't have to be a big international or a funded effort. Talk to the people around you. It's as simple as that.
Well, yeah. On that note, I mean, well. Thank you for coming here. We're an hour's up. I mean, this was fascinating. So, thanks a lot for everything you did, for showing up. So, and. Yeah. So yeah, Jason Brisebois, right? I love the pronunciation.
Yes, last thank name. You. You nailed it.
Yeah, and I also wanted to tell everybody some other stuff about you. I mean, Jason has lived a very very is living currently. Sorry, I didn't mean to put that in past tense. A very interesting life. I mean, he grew up in Canada and he grew up in the Ivory Coast and Sri Lanka. He's been a security professional and consultant for more than 30 years. He was a bodyguard for 18 years, and he was a bodyguard for celebrities, military, political, and executive. You were part of the Canadian Forces from 2016 to 2020, and then you were 2018 to 2020. You were part of the
I was part of the Canadian Forces. Sorry, was that a typo there? I joined in 2006. I got it in 2010. Ah,
that's a typo. Yeah. So yeah, 2006. Yeah, because you were in Afghanistan around 2009. 2000.
Yes. Okay, yes. So. Sorry, my bad. That was probably my bad there.
Yeah. Yep. No worries. So, I mean, that's you're also an animal rescuer. You run a charity called the Freegan Food Foundation. Well, let's talk about that in a second. You're a photographer, traveler, and an atheist. But so this charity that you run, the Freegan Food Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Food Foundation, yes.
Yeah. You want to tell us about that?
We're a charity that collects here in the island of St. Martin, where I live right now. We collect the food that grocery stores and supermarkets are going to throw out, generally vegan or vegetable-based products, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. That are past their best before date, or their served before date, that kind of thing, and anything the grocery stores are going to throw out, and we collect it and we give it to the poor. And right now we recover in and around 10,000 kilos of food a month that would have gone to landfill, gone to the garbage, and we're making sure it's getting into the mouths of people who need it. We feed between 3,000 to 4,000 families on the island, which is about 12,000 people roughly a month.
That's amazing. Yeah. So, before we lose, I need to read this comment before we lose more people. Sorry, I will get back to what you're saying. Dolly is saying, I love Secular Jihadist podcast. Very, very interesting and informative. I hope if it's possible to translate it into Arabic so people in Egypt can understand and be informed and stop listening to Egyptian media. Dolly, I know as a patron, we actually have plans to translate the show into other languages once we get to 500 patrons. So if you, this whole bottom-up approach that we're talking about to be able to like maybe change people's minds about you know, make the longer term investment in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, in Iran or Indonesia, Malaysia. Our plan is to do that by translating our shows into other languages, so to make it more accessible to more people. So if you get us to 500 patrons, we will be able to translate our show into Arabic, into Persian, into Urdu, and some Malay and some other Bengali, maybe, and some other languages. So please, if you are not a patron, please support this show. Link in the description. And if you can't support us financially, just please like our videos and share our videos as well. And also check out Jason's charity, because that seems like very helpful. So where can people find your charity? That's like,
let me get a quick link to that. Hang on one moment.
People are saying thanks, Jason. Thank you, Jason.
And
people
are saying awesome chat.
Thank you, Jason.
Yeah.
People are saying thanks for the discussion.
Yeah, I really think I'm gonna suggest this to you. I really think you should write do something to chronicle some of the things that the experiences you've had and the life you've lived. So
there's a long line of people behind you saying the same thing.
Yeah, there you go. But anyway, everybody who's listening to this, if you're hearing this and if you like what you hear, please do consider going to patreon.com/SJME. You can become a patron for less than as little as a dollar a month, and you would get like 5 episodes a month. You can watch them. You can interact just like we had here for everybody. You can comment, you can ask your questions, and you know, we always have fantastic guests or fantastic topics to talk about this stuff. And you'll get a perspective that you may not get in other places.
And also here's Jason's charity. It says Freegan Food Foundation. So check it out if you want to go. Oh yeah, look, this is very good. All right.
It's also on Facebook as well.
That's great.
All right, Jason, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Very informative. Thank you. Susanna is also saying this was extremely informative. All right, bye, guys.
Take care, Susanna. Thanks a lot. Bye.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.